This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 5th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 169th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Well, we're starting, as we mean to go on, with an interview with a big beast of the art world, none other than super dealer David Zwirner. We'll let this run long.
There's no substitute for being out there and taking in what's on offer. It's a responsibility that we have, that we keep looking, and not just at what's new, but also where things come from.
And when we're not chatting to David, we'll be looking ahead to the year in film with documentary maker Joshua Oppenheimer and a museum reopening in Beirut.
In the 1960s and in the early 70s, the museum played a very important role. It had a big impact on the artistic scene.
Plus, Icelandic electro band Gus Gus strip things down and take to the acoustic guitar and piano in this week's Midori House session. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. First things first, music from this week's Midori House session with Gus Gus. Over the last 20 years, the band has had various transformations, starting out life as an acting and film collective. Since then, they've split into a production company and an electro outfit and have released 10 albums altogether, establishing themselves as stalwarts of the trip-hop and dance music scenes. Mexico is their latest release on Compact Records and is a slick affair that draws on house and 90s dance music influences. The core band is currently a four-piece, including Biggie Vieira, who produced the album, and Hergni Egilson, who's playing for us today. We'll hear from them both later on in the show, but for now, here's Hergni with a very acoustic version of the brilliantly named Obnoxiously Sexual.
When you woke up, I guess you didn't know I would steal you from your girlfriend. Got filtered to the secret side, fed and raised by the fourth sky. Alone as we fly somewhere close, keep that in mind, and for the sake of simplicity, let's keep this between you and me. Obnoxiously sexual, who do we think we are? Come and sit with a right pout in it. Don't in my left, my spirit's distorted. Obnoxiously sexual, who do we think we are? Come and behold, it's a fight with limits of conscience raised and my spirit's distorted. Feeling me in the car, the pressure points of paramount importance. Going way too far, testing a limit, the endless minute. Delightfully sensual, shockingly despicably beautiful. I figure it's clear by now that love is a muscle of evil suggestion. Of evil suggestion. Of evil suggestion, for the sake of simplicity, let's keep this between you and me. Obnoxiously sexual, who do we think we are? Come and sit with a right bout in it. Don't in my life with my spirits distorted. Obnoxiously sexual, who do we think we are? Come and behold, it's a fight with limits of conscience raised and my spirit's distorted. With my limits distorted.
That was Gus Gus with Obnoxiously Sexual, one of the best song titles of the year already, and we'll hear from the band in conversation with Tom Hall later on in the show. We're We're going to start this new year as discussed, as we mean to go on with style and substance. We'll turn to an audience with a much admired titan of the contemporary art world. It's a mad place to which we might previously have alluded, so you need to know what you're all about. Someone that does is one of the kings of the gallery world, the German art dealer David Zwirner. His stable of artists includes Luke Toymans, Wolfgang Tillmans and Richard Serra, bright young things like Oscar Murillo, and the estates of modern masters like Dan Flavin and Donald Judd. Zwirner is the epitome of blue chip, and late last year we had a chat at his London gallery to make sense of the art world's maelstrom.
I would want to think that anybody that walks into this gallery and engages assumes that he will be dealing with an expert, whether that's myself or the people that work for me. You know, we communicate culture, we sell culture. We're not just selling things. And I hope that the type of culture, the type of artwork we sell transports meaning. So the moment you talk about meaning, you actually got to step back a little bit and reflect and communicate. So the idea to, it's very important that you spend time thinking about the history of art, the work that is in the gallery, and the ideas that an artist wants to project. We're not scholars, we're not academics, but I think we like to talk about the work that we present.
Do you have those days when you just want to sit in your office and lock the door and put some music on and concentrate on the books? I mean the art books, not the accounting books. I mean, do you know what I mean? Do you have that thing where you just, I don't want to meet these people today, and I kind of want to, you want to envelop yourself, you want to learn about something, you've got your eye on someone maybe, and you just want to slightly envelop yourself in that world. Can you afford to do that as such a sort of, it's such an international business and all the rest of it. Can you afford to do that?
You know, little dirty secret, I don't love reading criticism. I find a lot of art writing rather academic and rather opaque and difficult to penetrate. Once in a while, you come across a fantastic text that really guides you through a body of work or an artist's ideas. But very often, it's really one academic writing for another, right? So if I close the door and think about what I really want to do is, I would like to jump to the National Gallery and see the late Rembrandt show and the late Turners, and I haven't seen the Malevich show. So for me, it's really the looking that matters. And as a matter of fact, at the end of this freeze week, I'm going to Venice to look at art there, to see the architectural biennial. So there's no substitute for being out there and taking in what's on offer, you know? And I think that's really, you know, it's a responsibility that we have, that we keep looking, and not just at what's new, but also where things come from.
That's an interesting point. Do you think you have more of a collector's aesthetic in that sense, that you kind of, you have a visceral response to a work and you're like, you want to be in its orbit rather than scholastically studying stuff? There's maybe too much of that. It's interesting what you said about criticism. Maybe there's too much of that. There's maybe not enough straight questions. Why is this painting blue? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the... thank God I'm not a collector, because once you're a collector, you start competing with your collectors. But, you know, an editor, an impresario is a nice terminology. You know, again, we're part of culture. And, you know, we program our gallery not just through the artists that we invite to work with us, but also through the exhibitions that we put on. And the programming and this, impresario is a good word. That part I really enjoy. That's very gratifying.
I wanted to go back to the thing you were saying about criticism, and that you don't want to lock yourself in your office and just be reading criticism. Frankly, that doesn't surprise me. But it's an interesting thing. I interviewed Sean Scully. He said, there's not enough straight talking, really, in the art world. And he said, I painted a thing in the early 80s called This, That, and it's a big yellow canvas. And he said, it was a big red canvas, and I was painting it in New York, and it fell on me. He said, imagine being fallen on by something the size of a double bed mattress, and it's covered in red paint. So he said, to get my own back on it, I painted it yellow. Now, and he said, lots of people have sort of wondered why it's such a big yellow canvas with a little square of red in the corner. And he said, that's the reason why, because the damn thing fell on me. And these are the kind of stories. These are the kind of nice stories maybe to tell people. But there's not enough maybe of that when you talk about criticism. It's quite nice to have a lightness of touch and a wittiness to the way that you can talk about things. Is that kind of something important for you and something that you try to see in the staff that you employ? Because you've got 100 staff, haven't you? Now, I mean, it's a big gallery network. Is that what you look for? Do you look for a glint in someone's eye when you're hiring people?
Sean Scully's story is great. Shows you how hazardous the profession of an artist is. Love that. And actually, you're kind of going right where it's really interesting. We are privileged because we work with artists, so we are part of their process. You know, they do their thing in the studio, but you're close. There's so much intuition that goes into a great work of art. There's a lot of thinking that should go into it, but at the end of the day, there's really, you know, an immediacy in the process. And that is very difficult to write about. And that's why a lot of the writing is labored, because how are you going to get to that creative process in that moment? Being there when work was done, was made, or finding out about an accident. I'll give you a nice little story from Kerry James Marshall's show, right? Here it is. One of the key paintings is this beautiful couple sitting in a club. It's called The Club Couple. And I'm looking at the painting together with Kerry. And, you know, they're very happy, and he's smiling, and she's smiling. And all of a sudden, I look, oh, God, he's holding an engagement ring right behind her back. And he's looking at us. He's sharing that secret with us. I'd looked at that painting for quite a while, but I'd missed the engagement ring. So I said, oh, my God, Kerry, I didn't see the engagement ring. And he said, you know what? I just added that at the very end.
Yeah.
So then you're like, wait a second, that's what the whole painting is about, you know? And so you realize that art making is a process. You know, this is such a deliberate body of work, and you thought, Kerry's in the studio, he knows exactly where each of these paintings will go, but it's not true. The work is leading him on. And being privy to that is very wonderful.
I like the fact that you've obviously invested in bricks and mortar. There, you know, we're here in Mayfair. It's a beautiful building. I don't know how many stories. We're on the third floor, I think.
We got five.
We almost got lost in your lift, but anyway, we've got five stories. That's an investment, investing in bricks and mortar here and in New York. I wondered how important the facade of the gallery is. Going back to our young collector, maybe, or our non-mega wealthy collector, wanting to buy a work on paper, for example, how inclusive do you have to make the actual physical design of the spaces you make to show the work and to encourage people to come in actually off the street? Because contemporary art galleries, modern art galleries, sometimes people are scared, aren't they, to go in because they think they don't know the answers.
So just to dispel, you know, a potential misunderstanding, the galleries are really not built for the public. They're really built for the artist, because they're really our clients, quote unquote. So if I spend money on brick and mortar, I do so because I want to have spaces that inspire artists to make great shows. And once you have great shows, you have to assume a public will follow. I always thought that the program of the gallery is really what's the single most important thing. That's really who we are. And the facade is totally unimportant. If you come to our New York gallery on 19th Street, where I've got a couple of different galleries. One we built from scratch. I love the facade. The other one has been there for over 10 years, and the facade has been untouched and looks rather rough because I don't care, you know. What matters is what happens inside, you know. The spaces are absolutely crucial, but they're crucial because we want them to be enticing and convincing for artists.
That was David Zwerner, and we'll be hearing more from him later on in the show.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
You're You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We're off to Beirut now for a reopening worth keeping an eye on in 2015. After 8 long years of being closed to the public, the city's Soursok Museum is finally opening its doors, and it's set to become a jewel in a city sorely lacking in traditional cultural attractions. From the bourgeois home of a Lebanese noble to a museum and contemporary art gallery, the building has undergone huge changes in the last century and has nearly finished its latest transformation. Venetia Rainey reports.
Anyone who spends more than a week in Beirut is bound to stumble across the glorious Soursok Street. Ensconced in the heart of Shishi East Beirut, the legacy of the aristocratic Soursok family has been immortalised in a series of palatial buildings built along the road. Many are now used for high-end private events, but one has been closed to the public for 8 years and is only just reopening its doors, the Soursok Museum. Originally the home of Nicholas Ibrahim Soursok, it was gifted to the city in Beirut when he died in 1951 and quickly became a major feature on the art scene, as current director Zeyna Arida explains.
In the 1960s and in the early 70s, the museum played a very important role. It had a big impact on the artistic scene. The museum was very active in organizing different kinds of exhibitions. Some were focusing on local practices, and the main event, which was an annual event, was the Salon d'Automne.
The Salon d'Automne, modelled on the famous annual Parisian art exhibition of the same name, was an opportunity for up-and-coming Lebanese artists to debut their work, and for the Soursok Museum to snap up original and unique pieces.
The museum actually constituted its collection through mainly the Salon d'Automne. Its focus is mainly on Lebanese art from the 50s to 70s, I would say. But also some of the works that are in the collection were part of Nicolas Soursok's collection, which was not really an art collection. They have some icon, they have some ceramics. Of course, the core of the collection is mainly painting, ceramics, sculpture. There is some Islamic art. It's a very interesting collection.
Should we go and see some of your favorite pieces? Have a bit of a tour around the museum?
Yes. Yes, let's do this. So the first floor is what I call the historical aisle of the museum. It starts with the three spaces that are kept as they were when Nicolas Soursok was living in the house. The first space is his office. The story starts here, so it's nice to also somehow completely, build a narrative around the departure point of this museum. So from the donor's office, we go to a space which will tell the story a little bit of Beirut at the same, time. So we will host here a photo collection documenting Beirut in the early 20th century. And then you have the Salon Arabe of Nicolas Soursok. So this was his kind of diwan, where he used to have lots of, kind of salon littéraire, discussions with his friends from the intellectual, political, artistic scene.
And just to describe the room, for those who don't know what a diwan is, it's an amazing, very large room, and it has a sort of Ottoman-style seating in a crescent form at the furthest end, and these amazing marble columns.
And here you have two exhibition halls which will be used to introduce the collection of the museum. The idea is to give an overview of different artistic practices in Lebanon, with a focus on the 50s, 60s period.
Arida walks me through the modern part of the museum, which features a state-of-the-art auditorium for conferences and performances, a library to be packed with books on Lebanese art history and the museum's own invaluable archives, and an enormous white-walled room for temporary exhibitions. In the deepest recesses of the building is the art storage room, where the sound of the final bits of construction work mingles with the heavy silence of a room stuffed with paintings and furniture.
So you have here the big format paintings in this area. I can show you one of my favorites. Actually, here in this area, I have, you know, two that I really love. This one is it's a beautiful Etel Adnan painting, quite big format. It was the price of a Salon d'Automne, but I don't know exactly what was the year.
Just to describe what we're seeing here, it's these sort of unruly shapes and blocks with quite thick blobs of paint in all these different colours, ranging from sort of earthy browns and pinks to varying shades of blue up in the corner, I'm guessing, signifying sky. So it looks like a sort of landscape, right?
Yes, it's a mountain, actually. This is another Lebanese woman painter. Her name is Yvette Ash'ar. I know her work not so well. I know better Etel Adnan's work, but I love this painting.
And this is sort of an explosion of shards of colour set against a background which is sort of half pink and half very black.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something very severe and brutal about it, but also aesthetically pleasing.
Yes, yes. I think you described it very well.
Back in the auditorium, Arida gives a weary but determined smile as she talks about what is left to do. After years and years of false dawns, she has finally reached the last stage of her battle to bring the museum back to life.
It's getting, you know, more and more, I mean, exciting to start seeing it animated.
So I guess the big question on most Beirutis' minds is, when exactly is it going to open?
We really want to open in spring. There's a lot to do still, but we'll make sure to be able to open in spring.
The first exhibition is a look at how Beirut has been represented over the last 160 years, an ambitious and exciting start for the museum that is bound to garner heaps of attention. Art lovers of the Middle East, take note. This springtime, the place to be is Beirut. You heard it here first. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Thanks, Venetia. Coming up in the second half of the show, we'll have more from gallerist David Zwerner, and we'll look to the year ahead in film with Little White Lies magazine's David Jenkins and American documentary maker Joshua Oppenheimer. That's all to come on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. But first, we'll hear from the band behind this week's session, Gus Gus. They nipped into the studio to tell Monocle's Tom Hall about their latest record, Mexico, and why it pays to act like Elton John in the studio.
I'm joined by Høgni and Biggie from Gus Gus, and we're talking a little bit about Iceland's fascination with scatting and how you can incorporate that into the interview setting, which you seem to be doing very successfully.
We're realizing it.
Yeah.
Putting it into realization.
I was just suggesting that maybe Høgni should just scat the interview, you know.
Just scat the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. I just maybe answer, then he takes it into a scatting mode. Yeah. Just like an add-on.
Add-on, yeah. Developing. Yeah.
Perfect.
Like,
procession.
This is the 8th album, and I say, 8th, I got something, you know?
Yeah, well, you should leave the scatting to me.
Okay, leave the scatting to me.
I'm the scat man.
I think scatting is it's quite a, you have to kind of lose yourself in it.
You can't
be self-conscious about it.
No, yeah, well, I think that can be translated onto all art, and from there that can be translated onto all creation, I believe. But so I think inside the core of scatting, there lies a hidden truth about the wonders of the world.
But the truth about this relationship with scatting is because of this figure called Egill Ólafsson in Iceland, who was in this big band, who was big in the 70s, and he kind of overscat us with his scatting.
He overscat us. There used to be nothing but boy.
You're supporting your new album, Mexico. Tell us a little bit about maybe the album and also some of the songs you just played.
Both of those songs are songs from the album.
Well, I recognised Obnoxiously Sexual because it's a great title and I knew that one. The other one was much more kind of soulful, sort of touching song.
Yeah.
You said that you were trying to sort of channel your inner Elton John. maybe it was just your interpretation of it.
Well,
I didn't quite catch.
I mean, I don't think Elton John as an entity has anything to do with it. It's more about him and his approach there in studio. When I say I'm going to do this like Elton John, means that I'm going to deliver a take, which is good because he just went in the studio. He kind of, what I heard was that he just walked in the studio and, I mean, that's the story.
One take man,
but you know, that's what I said. But that song is called God Application and it's bouncy on the album, pretty jivey, sexy mode there. But I put it in a little bit of a soulful setting, I believe.
No scatting, though.
No. It was pretty intimate.
As far as Iceland goes, I mean, is there exciting music coming out of there at the moment? We were just talking before the mics were on about a studio up there and another guy called Biggie, who we kind of communally both know. But I remember when I spoke to him, he was like, yeah, because Iceland's quite small, like all the musicians know each other and everyone sort of knows what's going on and supports each other. Is that the case or is that just some deranged fancy?
Like, well, I mean, that's an answer that's been just sort of like a template answer for a long, long time. Yeah, everybody knows each other, it's small, and we support each other. Yeah, it doesn't sound really exciting, does it?
I think my point was, because you know each other, maybe you can tell us of some exciting things coming out of
Exactly. Well,
yeah, I can name at least one of my favorite bands at the moment, is Mammoth. I really love the album that they came out with last year. It's amazing.
Cool.
Really, that's a cool album, really. I love the singer Kata. She is... they actually won us at the award ceremony in Iceland. It was pretty, but we're dear friends. It's fine.
They beat you.
They beat us. At my other band, and it's cool. But their album was really great. Yeah.
The album is called Mexico. What's that title referring to? Is it the country itself? Or?
Yeah, I figure it's the country itself. I would like to say it is a title which was somehow you put an object out there, you throw it up in the sky, and you follow it. And I feel that that's what happened with Mexico. We found Mexico. It felt with us. It came to us instinctually. And we said, that's something. And then somehow it came and all these ideas and meanings were added on it. And ultimately, it wasn't realized fully until we went to Mexico last month, 2 weeks ago, when we went and had big shows there, putting our sort of mind into reality.
So it's kind of about almost visualizing a goal, almost.
Without sounding too much, not too much new age bull.
Without sounding like a dick.
Yeah.
That's, like he's describing, it's kind of just a title that came up and slowly convinced us. So it was a title that wanted to be and...
It gave itself territory and space.
It was not our choice.
It just came on. Exactly, and that's a mighty lesson, isn't it? You know, when you just release and you say, I don't have a choice about this, it just happened. Let's just do it, carry on.
That was Hergni and Biggie from Icelandic band Gus Gus speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall, and their latest record, Mexico, is out now. Now, if you were listening to The Globalist last week, you'll have heard our look ahead to 2015 in film, art, music and television. For the film side of things, I was joined by David Jenkins, editor of Little White Lies magazine and therefore a fountain or a font of knowledge on what we'll be seeing on the silver screen this year. Here's David.
I want to make you rich. You see the palm trees? They tell you anything's possible.
No one cares about reality anymore.
They are like flavors. Sometimes you want raspberry, then after a while you want some strawberry.
You have love in you. I know it.
Blind.
Night of Cups is a movie that I am very, very, very excited about. So Terrence Malick is this director who started off in the 70s and made Badlands and Days of Heaven and created this amazing aura around him. So he had this first phase, then he went away for like 30 years and then made Thin Red Line and The New World. And now he's kind of in this third phase where he's making these movies like To the Tree of Life and To the Wonder, which are kind of, you sort of taken He gets big A-list actors in, films scenes with them, just has them improvising and shoots on digital so he can shoot and shoot and shoot and gets just gets reams of material. And then he'll go away for 2 years and kind of patch it together. So there's no sort of enforced narrative to these movies. They're just sort of, you know, splurges of emotion and things happening and time switching. And
is Knight of Cups, because is Knight of Cups, do you think it's in this similar vein? Is he gone?
It looks to be. It was kind of strange. It had been sort of announced 2 years ago, and there was this very elusive kind of description of what it was going to be. So, and we knew that Christian Bale was going to be in it, Cate Blanchett and Natalie Portman was going to be in it, but nothing, you know, nobody knew when it was going to come out and whether it was finished or who would end up in the final cut. It was announced that it was going to be at the Berlin Film Festival in February, and then a trailer dropped as well, which I think I certainly was quite excited by that.
Where are we going to go next? There's a film called The Lobster.
Oh, right, yeah.
Talking of weird, Knight of Cups and The Lobster. It's like someone's just jumbled up some movie titles and put them on the page here. What's this one?
This is a new film from a Greek director called Yorgos Lanthimos. You may know him from a film from 2008 called Dogtooth, which was a very strange movie in which it was kind of vaguely riffing on that whole kind of Joseph Fritzl situation with a father who has imprisoned his children in this big house and won't let them outside for these kind of quite vague moral reasons. And then any kind of language pertaining to the outside world, him and his wife have, you know, explained that those, you know, if they see a plane going overhead, they say, oh, that's a telephone. And, you know, they've mixed up language.
It's an amazingly imaginative film, actually. That was a phenomenal idea, wasn't it?
But I mean, his whole thing is he sort of takes quite sort of traditional narratives and subverts something that you generally wouldn't subvert, like just the way people talk, you know, in that film. And this movie seems to have a similar thing. Again, not much is known about it other than its sort of logline, which is incredible. It centres on a hotel in which the guests who arrive there have 1 week to find a mate, or they're turned into an animal and set out into a nearby woodland.
That's amazing! What a great idea! Now there's a good cover story for a little while.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's just so crazy that I'm just really, really hoping the film is great, as great as its logline.
that's absolutely phenomenal, isn't it?
Do you think one of the animals is a lobster? Is that why the film is called Lobster?
I think it might be.
That's quite exciting.
You wouldn't want to be a lobster set loose in a woodland, would you? You'd literally a fish out of water.
It does pose the question. It's like, what would you rather? Would you rather find a mate in a hotel or go and be a unicorn? You know?
I think for me, the lobster, there's great ingredients there and a great setup, but I'm hoping that there's a kind of another extra element that we find out when we see the film, and I'm sure it's going to be there, but I think that's the really exciting thing about seeing, not just seeing how this idea plays out, but seeing how it develops, basically. So
big pot of boiling water. We've got some clips lined up. Can I play one? I'm itching to play one.
Play one in.
What do you want? Should we have a bit of Selma?
Mm.
What I need to know right now, what's Martin Luther King about to do next?
Mr. President, Dr. King is here.
Mr. President, in the South, there have been thousands of racially motivated murders.
We need your help, Dr. King. This thing's just going to have to wait.
It cannot wait.
You got one big issue, I got 101.
Summer it is.
It is unacceptable that they use their power to keep us voiceless. We must march. We must stand up.
You march those people into rural Alabama, it's got to be open season.
The title is referring to a civil disobedience campaign instigated by Martin Luther King in 1968. Selma is a town in Alabama where the kind of focus of civil rights energies were focused to try and attain voting rights for blacks. And I think the most amazing thing about this film, it's directed by a black female director called Ava DuVernay, who's not particularly well known. I don't think this is going to be her sort of big breakthrough movie. The great thing about the movie is that it stays very neutral and very objective.
It allows you to make your own judgment
on
these things.
You watch the movie and it's just saying, look at this kind of quite small, momentous, but sort of quite small scale event that happened in this small town in 1968. And make your own assumptions.
And that's a nice narrative conceit to focus on, you know, one day or one part of this great man's life rather than doing the kind of big biopic kind of thing.
And that's, I think, what's great about it is that it does, even though it focuses very specifically on this, on these few weeks, I think, it kind of still operates as a biography of Martin Luther King, because it does just naturally touch on all these issues with his life, and you find out about the fact that he had affairs with other women, and, you know, how he joined smaller factions together to sort of create a united voice. And it sort of touches on his relationship with Malcolm X as well. And I mean, it's really quite exceptional.
That was David Jenkins speaking to me for a special edition of The Globalist last week. And you can catch the full interview on monocle.com. And while we're talking about things we'll be watching in 2015, we're now going to hear from a documentary maker whose upcoming release will be available to watch this spring. Joshua Oppenheimer is the mind behind 2012 film The Act of Killing, which won a BAFTA and was nominated for an Oscar, and it's a wonderful film. His new one, The Look of Silence, is very much a companion piece to that movie, returning to the subject of the mid-1960s Indonesian genocide. Michael Booth spoke to Oppenheimer about making the film and the problems surrounding the documentary medium.
Tidak, saya menganggap itu tidak besar.
Bagaimana mungkin tidak besar? 1 juta orang dibunuh atau lebih.
Sebenarnya politik.
We knew from the beginning that we were making two films. There's a scene in The Look of Silence, which is in fact the genesis of both films, where two men shot over a decade ago, take me down to a riverside where they'd helped the army to kill 10,500 people. And they kind of gleefully show me how they went about it, taking turns playing victim and perpetrator, complaining that they hadn't thought to bring along weapons to use as props. And I had this feeling while shooting that I was witnessing a boasting which is not a result of people being crazy, but actually a whole political system which is crazy. It felt as though I'd wandered into Germany 40 years after the Holocaust, only to find the Nazis still in power. And I knew then, more than a decade ago, that I would drop everything I was doing and spend as many years as it would take to address this situation. And I knew there would be two films to make, one about what happens to a whole country, to our common humanity, when we build a whole political system on terror and lies, when killers win and build a whole system to justify their atrocities and enabling them to continue committing atrocities. And that became The Act of Killing. But I also knew there was an equally contemporary film to make, a film about today, as opposed to the events of 1965, about what does it do to human beings to have to live for 50 years, to continue to survive in silence and in fear, surrounded by the still powerful people who killed their relatives, the still powerful murderers. That became The Look of Silence.
Jadi kepiye perasaan Mama tinggal cerok di antara pembunuh anak Imam.
The protagonist of The Look of Silence is this extraordinary man and a very dear friend of mine, Adi Rukun, who is an optometrist. He goes door to door as his job, selling glasses, testing people's eyes. And typically whenever he tests someone's eyes who's over 50 or 60 years old, he asks them what they remember of 1965. And he started doing that because of his relationship to me. You see, I began this work with the survivors on a plantation where there was one oil palm plantation in North Sumatra, Indonesia, where there was one victim in particular whose name was synonymous with the whole genocide, a man named Ramli. He was synonymous because, unlike all the other victims from the area, his murder had witnesses. So to talk about Ramli was somehow to insist that these events had really happened. You imagine you've been traumatized, but the government has threatened everybody into pretending that the source of the trauma had never occurred.
He was undeniable.
He was undeniable. To speak about Ramli was almost to pinch yourself, to remind yourself that you're awake, that you're sane, that this is real. And so very quickly, when I began this work, I was introduced to Ramli's family, and I fell in love with his parents, who are both in the film. And then very quickly, I was introduced to Adi, Ramli's youngest brother. He was born after the killings and consequently is not as traumatized as everybody else in his family and in the community. And he never knew his older brother who was murdered. Well, first he attached to my filmmaking project a decade ago as a way of trying to answer this question of why is his country like this? His parents were too afraid even to tell him what had happened to his older brother, lest he should go to school and talk about it during recess and then get the whole family and above all himself in trouble. So he saw my filmmaking process as a way of understanding what happened to his family.
There's been some controversy about documentary makers fictionalizing, recreating. Do you have a problem with drawing that line, calling what you do documentary?
I often talk about what I do as nonfiction. I do that because I think to simply get away from the journalistic nuance of the word documentary, because I fundamentally think that nonfiction film is always about people playing themselves for the camera. We're told by fly-on-the-wall filmmakers that if you film someone for long enough, they forget that the camera's there. Well, unless you're filming a very small child or animals who are unaware of the camera's presence, no one ever confuses the state of being alone with the state of being observed by a camera crew that has the power to write your whole future. Imagine you're alone talking to your mother versus you're sitting with your mother talking, but there's a camera crew. You could not possibly forget the difference between those two situations. And if you appear to, it's because you've learned how to act for the camera. You've learned how to, quote unquote, act natural. So I think that if we acknowledge that nonfiction film is simply filming people playing themselves, and if we acknowledge that the self-consciousness that that inevitably engenders is an opportunity to see how they want to be seen. And
it's more honest in a way to have them recreate themselves.
Well, I don't really care about the issue of honesty and the sort of whole orthodoxy of what's honest or what's not. I think that there's a missed opportunity in clinging to an orthodoxy in which we actually pretend dishonestly, no doubt, that people are just unaware of the camera. And I think it's a missed opportunity precisely because whenever you film anybody, they start acting out the scripts to which they wish they lived up. They start performing. They start showing you how they want to be seen. And from that, you can easily infer how they really see themselves. There is no such thing as a person in their true, honest, pure state. And performance can be a lens into something that's truthful and much deeper than we're able to see without the performative facade. I think that a way of thinking about this is that whenever you film anybody, it becomes a series of occasions, hopefully safe occasions, for somebody to reveal something that they wouldn't otherwise reveal, to prolong an argument, to make a confrontation, to say something they'd normally be too afraid to say, to allow a conversation to go on longer than it otherwise would. In the Look of Silence, many people have commented that the conversations go on way beyond. Adi decides to confront these men. These scenes are not interviews, and that their purpose is not to get information from these men. They're dramatic, tense confrontations between two characters who are each trying to do something through these scenes. The presence of the camera is surely what makes it safe for Adi to have those conversations. Now, those conversations are unprecedented, not just in Indonesia, but in the history of nonfiction film, in that I don't think you've ever seen a documentary where survivors confront perpetrators while the perpetrators are still completely in power. At the end of the film, Rohani, the mother, cries. And she cries for the first time, she told us afterwards, since her son was murdered. And she couldn't have cried.
Nearly 50 years ago.
50 years ago. She cries because of the whole filmmaking process that brings the sole survivor of the massacre to her house, which is when she cries. And that only happens because of a whole filmmaking journey through which all these confrontations are possible.
Seandainya aku berbicara di era Orde Baru sama Bapak, apa yang akan Bapak lakukan dengan aku?
That was Joshua Oppenheimer speaking to Monocle's Copenhagen correspondent Michael Booth. After the break, we return to David Zverner. Stay tuned.
Outspoken, in demand, and still at the top of his game, fashion designer Karl Lagerfeld talks to Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé about the industry, the media, and why Berlin isn't as good as it used to be.
For me, Berlin is like a human body with an arm and a leg missing. What they did there, the Russians, made it forever something what has not the soul Berlin was famous for. I know so well the past of Berlin and the spirit of Berlin. And for me, there is not enough left from what Berlin was all about.
Karl Lagerfeld in conversation with Tyler Brulé on Film, premiering now on Monocle.com.
You are listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Now, to end the show, we're going to hear from gallerist David Zwerner again. He tells me about why he decided against becoming a jazz drummer, the art of collecting, and the defining moment that made him want to open that first gallery of his.
The impetus was really the folly of youth. You know, I was in my mid-20s, and I was ready to... I wanted to have my own little kingdom. And that's the beauty of running a gallery. You really are in charge of your own destiny, and you can shape what you're doing. Of course, you shape it through the people that you bring in and work with you, but, you know, mainly again through the program. There were two key moments. There was one, there was a documenter, and documenter is an important show, Kassel, every 5 years. In 92, a great curator from Belgium put it together, Jan Hood. He passed away last year. And Jan's 92 documenter was a shock to my system. There's such powerful art there. A lot of the artists that were in that documentary are now in my gallery. It's the first time I saw Luke Toymans, Marlene Dumas' work, Stan Douglas' work, Raoul de Keyser's work, Jim Welling. So there's a whole group, Franz West. A lot of art that I saw there just seemed so open-ended. And ironically, a lot of these artists have come to the gallery later. They were already with other situation, so it, you know, took time. And then there was a great show in 1992 in Los Angeles called Helter Skelter.
Great name for anything.
Yeah, exactly. And that show was a regional show, quote unquote. It really just focused on art from in and around Los Angeles. It was curated by Paul Schimmel, a great friend. It showed me the work of Paul McCarthy, of Raymond Pettibone, of Mike Kelly, Charlie Ray, and it's such a riveting, such a like raw sensibility that I realized I needed, you know, I know where I wanted to locate the gallery from a content point of view. Now I just had to find, I had to get there. So, but that was really, without that, you know, I think probably the directions would have gone different.
Yeah, it's one of those things, it's nice to hear the sort of the creation myth, you know, it's that thing. People are very interested in that sort of thing. It's like, what first got you into this? Because it can be any number of things, you know, it can be any number of things. I read also that you wanted to be a jazz musician. That's the toughest thing in the world. There's a film about to come out which shows being a jazz drummer as basically the most terrifying thing. It's worse than being fallen on by a huge painting, I think. The most terrifying and physical thing in the universe. Was there an element of that, that like being a jazz drummer is a even more precarious persuasion as being a gallerist?
You know, I had given up the jazz drummer dream a couple of years earlier. I love jazz, and I have the greatest respect for the music and the people that do it, and I think it's so underappreciated. But it is a super tough life, and life gets, you know, the more talented you are, the better the life gets. But I felt I was just in the medium to lower medium talent bracket. And while I could hold my own, I didn't feel I was up there with those that were just, you know, they're naturals. I wasn't a natural, you know. That realization helped me to let go and move on to other things. But it's great. I'm still very much involved in the music by listening and you know, I know what's happening, so it's good.
I'm trying to look on your bookshelves here to see if there's any old records. Are you interested in talking about the physical? We've talked about investing in bricks and mortar. We're quite interested in that, at Monocle, actually, in the idea of the physical. We sell a paper magazine that you would not want to swat a fly on your window with for fear of breaking the window. But are you interested in buying old vinyl? Are you into it like that? Are you a fetishistic music lover, or do you just want to put the CD on in your car and enjoy it that way? Does it matter to you, that stuff?
I'm not an audiophile and not a fetishist, and I kind of succumbed to Spotify, I have to say.
The enemy,
exactly. But guess what? I'll still buy the CDs. I have a big CD collection. I do it literally out of sense of duty. You know, when I'll check it out on Spotify, and if it's a great record, I'll get a CD.
Nice. At least he's honest. And in terms of that, the collecting thing, is that, that's obviously something you do yourself. There's, I wonder how similar the work on your walls at home is to the work on in the gallery.
You know, you come to my house and you will see almost exclusively work by artists and artist estates who we represent. And that's great. I just love to live with the work of those that I know personally, that are friends, that whose career I've been able to accompany. If I had unlimited means, I would dip into, you know, other areas. I think I would be interested in buying antiquities and maybe old masters, you know, but just like look at different periods of you know, the production of culture, which I find fascinating. But I am not a collector. That's the good news. So I'm fortunate that I can live with a lot of great art in my house that sort of passed through the gallery one way or the other.
Looking at stuff in a contemporary gallery is one way of looking, maybe. And looking at stuff at an art fair is another way of looking. And looking at stuff in a museum is another way of looking. Is that the same for you? Do you breathe a sigh of relief sometimes when you're in the Louvre or in the Tate or in the National Gallery or wherever you are, that you can relax because it's not for sale?
We work in culture, right? So you actually produce things that are meant to be around. You know, we're not selling things that you're going to discard once they're no longer functional. So of course, going to a museum is very reassuring because, you know, that is where it's supposed to be. Only the smallest fraction of 1% will make it there. But, you know, that's the mission. So that's why we do what we do. And, you know, it's also good business because the institutions reinforce what we present to our clients. So if we can get our artists into the institutions, values will go up and the clients will be reassured that they're part of something. I like art fairs, they're fine, but there's absolutely no comparison to the experience that you will have going to a gallery, seeing a show where you see a group of 15 paintings. Kerry James Moss's show, point in case. He's an artist that is not well known. He hasn't had a show in London in 10 years. He hasn't had many shows on the continent. So what's happening right now during Frieze Week, people come and see the work for the first time. And because they see a group of paintings, they can really make up their mind. They can see the complexity of his project. You go to an art fair, you see one painting, you might be intrigued, but you will have to learn more. So the art fair is a great and very democratic way to enter for those that want to join the art world and talk to us and see what we're doing. And it's an interesting way for the very, very sophisticated to fill gaps. But, you know, all I can say, make sure that if you want to enter the art world, you spend time in the galleries.
That was David Zwirner bringing us to the end of this week's show. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher. Happy New Year, Holly. Time for one final song this week from Monocle's Midori House session. Here are Gus Gus with God Application. Thank you for tuning in.
Who are you, my God Application? Our attraction, our perversion. Are you teasing me? I come and close where I see you leaving him for me. All these ifs and whys and buts, still my eyes follow, full of lust. I'll always want more of you, baby. The warmth of the body that my hands are on. I'll always want more of you, baby. The warmth of the body that my hands are on. Who are you, my God Application? our attraction, our perversion. Are you teasing me? Ooh, coming close where I see. You're leaving him for me. Ooh. All these ifs and whys and buts, still my eyes follow, are full of love. I'll always want more of you, baby. I'll always want more of you, baby. I'll always want more of you, baby. The warmth of the body that my hands are on.